I'm just loving this show. Adrian Mayer, the author of two very interesting books, one of which is considered a real breakthrough book, The First Fossil Hunters. And it deals with especially with the sort of the art record of ancient Greece and Roman times, the things that they depicted, things like griffins. And then exploring where the bones were, what led them to start drawing pictures of feathered, covered, flying reptile type beasts. It's really interesting. It would be what we're talking about, just for the same reason that the first Americans did it too. They would come across these bones and try to figure out, like we would, all right, where do these come from? What were these? And in so many of the stories of the first Americans, we have passed down from generation to generation actual accounts of many of these beasts. We'll talk about this in just a second, too. How did they get it so right when it comes to the cover of fossil legends of the first Americans? How was it that in the middle of the desert, these early Native Americans understood that at one time there had been an ocean there, and that in the ocean were water monsters? How did they get that right thousands of years before the real stories of paleontology starts to try to make the same explanations? We'll get to that coming up on Coast to Coast AM, and then the UFO stories too this hour, I promise. I absolutely in the next 30 minutes before we start getting your calls too. For Adrian Mayer on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Ponet. Adrian Mayer, author of Fossil Legends of the First Americans. We never got back to the flying snakes thing too, so I can't forget that either. See, this is what happens when you got such a rich material. I'm gorging myself.
I'll remind you about those.
I just pull up a chair at the buffet at the Ponderosa, and I just sit there and eat. Fossil Legends of the First Americans cover, it's very interesting, and I like the painting of the. It sort of it makes very clear the relationship for these early Americans, how they saw what the possibilities were for these bones they were discovering. So you have in there this depiction of a pterodactyl of some sort or pterosaur of some sort eating or being eaten by, depending how you look at it, some sort of water beast. Talk about that cover and what that signifies and what we learn from it.
Well, the cover was painted by Pete Von Schaale, who he's a wonderful artist who works on Hollywood animation films. He's quite famous, and I was really pleased that he did this cover. I really love it. He calls the painting Spirit Battle. It shows a pterodactyl fighting with a large mosasaur, which is a huge marine reptile. Both these fossils are found in the high plains, especially in South Dakota. And they're, fully articulated, and they're found next to each other. So when Native Americans came through this area, they lived there, they observed keenly. They knew that this area had been underwater because they found the fossils of fish. Shells are everywhere. There are clam shells, all kinds of shells, fish fossils, turtle fossils, and then these huge water monster-like creatures, the marine reptiles. They are water monsters. And then right next to them are these huge flying reptiles. So naturally, you think this was underwater. This was the water monster that lived here along with these other sea creatures. And flying above was its dire enemy, this flying reptile, the
Well, see, that's the
Thunderbird.
interesting part. I don't know that I mean, I think that that's to their brilliance that they were able to separate out those two. Why would they just make that separation that, oh, this one flew and this one swam, when they both have when they both have essentially, non they don't have
They have, and there's
arms or
nothing like them.
legs.
There's nothing like these creatures.
Right.
But you can see that one of them has wings. I mean, they're very obvious in the pterodactyl fossils that are found in the chalk. You can see the wings. They're membrane wings, so it's more like a bat wing. But they can, in a passerby can recognize that that's a winged creature.
Yeah,
But
I'm gonna push you a little bit further on that. I think we do, and I think we would look at that way, and I know I would, and But I wonder whether, I think it's, I mean, we find species all the time underwater that like, for example, like a giant manta ray, right? Which has big wings. Like, I mean, there's a way of saying that they actually looked at that and they were able to intellectually separate this one flew and this one swam.
Yeah.
That I don't want to take that too for granted that that was so obvious. I mean, I think that shows a real sense of nuance about what these bones said.
It shows some brilliant insight. And of course, they're observing this over time, over generations. And they're talking about it. They're speculating. They're trying to come up with a coherent, rational story to explain this evidence that they see constantly.
Right.
And that they can discuss it with each other. They can discuss it with their elders. Somebody else finds, you know, more evidence or something that sort of explains something. This isn't just a one-shot deal. They're doing this over generations, over thousands of years.
Well, let's talk about the flying snakes then. So, and
flying
again, because I mean, I love never
that story because there's a story from ancient Egypt and Greece about flying snakes, and then there's one. There are many of them in the Americas. So,
well, okay. Like so, what did they do? Were they flying poisonous snakes? Were they just? I mean, were they? How do we try to picture them, like dragonflies?
Let's start with the flying reptiles of Egypt. The ancient Greek historian Herodotus was writing in the 5th century BC. That's 2,500 years ago. He's visiting Egypt, and he says, "Show me the flying snakes. I've heard about the flying snakes." And the priests take him out, and they say, "Yeah, we've got flying snakes, and we'll show you the evidence." They take him to a kind of narrow pass in the desert. We don't know where it is. There are some guesses where it was, but nobody's sure. This story mystifies all the scholars. Nobody can figure this out. They showed him bones and backbones and of winged snakes, just thousands of them piled up in heaps. Some were big, some were small. It's one of the most cryptic passages in all of ancient history. No one can figure it out. Was it, you know, like thousands of dead locusts? Was it, were they lizards with these sort of membrane-like things? There are some lizards that do that. Was he looking at pterosaur fossils? Nobody knows. And yet he wrote it down and said, "I guess they do have flying snakes in Egypt." No one can figure it out. Now, there's some support for this. There's a Roman writer, Cicero, pretty famous, was a statesman, but he's a politician, and yet he also stated in one of his speeches that there were winged reptiles that occurred in the western desert of Egypt. So once again, we've got, you know, someone else who believes the story. Somebody, you know,
right?
Said, this is a, you know, a rational human being.
Right. And at the same time, there are these Native American stories going on.
Exactly. There was a, I interviewed the granddaughter of a medicine man from the Crow tribe. His name was Gozahead, or Bazakush. He died in 1919. And he actually had a vision quest. And this is not unusual, apparently. There are many stories about Native Americans in other tribes, especially in the Southwest and the western part of the United States, going on vision quests or being out in the desert, very isolated desert mountain areas, and seeing flying snakes. So this guy was having his vision quest, noticed what he thought was a bird flying very awkwardly. It was sort of unbalanced, as if the body was sort of too heavy for the wings. So it was flying awkwardly, and it fell down at his feet. And he saw that it had wings, but it wasn't a bird. It was more like a snake or a lizard. Long, heavy body, serpentine, he said. And it had double wings like a dragonfly. But it wasn't a dragonfly. He said, no, this was some sort of reptile or lizard or snake. He picked it up. He took it home. He put it in his medicine bundle. He then participated in the great battle of the Little Bighorn where Custer was defeated. He survived. He was one of the scouts for Custer. He survived, and he gave credit to the weird creature that he had found. This flying snake had saved his life. So he climbed a tree after the battle. This is 1876. He climbed a tree up on a ridge there above the battlefield, and he carved up an image of this mysterious creature, this flying reptile. He carved it on the tree. Well, everybody forgot about this except for his granddaughter used to go out and see it with her grandfather and her father. They'd go and look at this carving on the tree. She's dead now, so I talked to her just before she died in 2004, and she told me that there was a guy in 1973 who had found the tree and took a Polaroid picture of it. And I found that guy, and he was 84 years old, and he said, the Polaroid has faded, but I can draw you a sketch from memory. He actually climbed the tree and saw the mark. So I've got a picture. It just gives me shivers because I don't know what that was.
But
I have talked to paleontologists, and they say, we don't know what that could be.
Right. And now, do they say it, honestly, I mean, do they say it like, we don't know what that would be like, okay, go away, lady? Or do they say it like,
no, paleontologists love this stuff.
Okay, they do.
Paleontologists love mysteries. They're like you and me.
Okay, good. Good,
because
that is just too cool.
Yeah. And they loved thinking about what could this be and just racking their brains.
But if a guy found it at the time of, you know, Western expansion by white settlers, you would almost think that there would have to be similar stories, say, in the early days of the formation of Mormon communities or any of these pioneering groups out in the middle of nowhere, they would have almost seemingly naturally encountered something like that if they were still, you know, thrive, if these flying snakes were still thriving.
Yeah, maybe they're discouraged from talking about it or writing it down or, you know, keeping record of it. Whereas among Native Americans, you go on a vision quest, you're expecting to see something.
Right.
Something amazing.
True. Well, I guess in a way you could say the story of Noah this account of
Jonah in the whale.
Oh, I'm sorry. I said Noah, didn't I? Jonah,
yeah.
Of course.
Jonah.
Right. And you look at, because I was thinking about the flood stories, too, for something else. Yeah. So Jonah going out, you know, going to Nineveh, and here he is, you know, cast out, and he's swallowed by a giant beast.
Yeah.
So talk to me about that, you know, maybe, I mean, we say big fish, it's what it is, and we insert whale to try to make that make sense. And I wonder whether we're blowing that. Maybe there is something else that could have existed at the time that we just don't have a fossil record of yet.
Well, and Jonah's story in the Bible is only one of the stories about a giant, gigantic, I mean, we're talking massive sea creature. I mean, the Greeks called it a ketos, sea monster.
Right.
There are a bunch
of Leviathan.
There are other stories. There's a famous story in Pliny the Elder of a Roman guy who was in Joppa, which is in what is now Israel in Haifa, found the skeleton of a gigantic sea creature. He thought it was a sea creature because he found it on the shore. So that's how he assumed that it was a sea creature. But there was also the myth of Perseus rescuing his girlfriend Andromeda from a giant sea monster there. So he thought he'd found the remains of the whatever this was, the sea monster. This guy actually gathered up the bones, apparently numbered them so that he could put it all together again, shipped it back to Rome, and they reconstructed it in Rome in the theater, and they showed how big it was by putting something like 25 bears inside it. So this is some kind of big sea creature. Nobody knows what it really was. They guessed that it was a whale, but no, the Mediterranean isn't famous for its whales,
right? Or giant whales, for that matter.
No, and there are some instances, reported instances of whales getting confused, going through the rock, going past Gibraltar, and getting into the Mediterranean, and then getting stranded on the shore. That does happen in modern times.
Yeah, but not like a right whale. Not like a.
Not something
wouldn't,
huge.
That big, where you get 25 bears in it, kind of.
I don't think so. And there's another story of a gigantic carcass also found on the shore. This time, I think in what is now Lebanon, and this was seen by a Roman officer and his entire legion. So there's a lot of witnesses for it.
Yeah.
Still, nobody knows what it was. So
very interesting.
Yeah.
The relationship between the stories, history, science, and these stories, which we too often dismiss as myths. So that brings us to the UFO question. Now, what's this about? Because I understand that you, in your search through these records, you've come across kind of an unexplainable story of a different type.
Well, I love these unexplained stories. As you know, that's what keeps me going, is just finding these things that need explanation, and then just put our heads together and try to figure out what in the world were they trying to describe back then. So I noticed that there were a few stories about the catastrophic events that were thought to kill all of the giant monsters that were found by Native Americans. Some of those stories sound like they might have been trying to describe a meteor impact or a asteroid impact or maybe even a UFO event. So,
okay, what are those stories?
Well,
I'm on the edge of my seat. I paid for the whole chair, but I'm only using the very front edge of it. So tell me.
Well, and then we're going to get to the Greek and Roman stories of UFOs, which are even more exciting.
Okay,
they've
good.
Got even more details. So ask me about that. First, Ecuador and Peru, when the Spanish arrived there, the natives of Ecuador and Peru, along the coast, western coast of South America, said that they showed them huge bones that they had collected, and they displayed these and said, these were the giants that invaded our land from the sea. They arrived by sea. They just appeared on our coast. They had eyes as big as dinner plates. They were huge and hairy. They just came onto our shore, and they started harassing us and killing us and preying on us. And then all of a sudden, after putting up with this for some generations, a huge blast of fire came from the heavens, just blinding flash of light, destroyed all these giants that had come from the sea, and fire consumed them. All that's left are these burnt bones.
Okay, freaky.
Yeah. Then there's another one, the Assiniboine Sioux story. I like this one because it's Montana. I spent a lot of time in Montana. They also found a lot of dinosaur fossils, and their explanation for what happened, why were all these dinosaurs, they didn't call them dinosaurs, but why were all these monsters, why had they all been killed en masse? What could have killed all of them at once? They imagined a catastrophe, and it was an astronomical event. The Assiniboine Sioux, also known as the Cutthroat Sioux, their story was a spectacular thing that they referred to as a thunder rock. It was a large black projectile that came whistling and screaming out of the western sky with a terrible velocity. It was a deafening noise, a blinding flash, and all the creatures died. And then there was a weather change. There were raging fires everywhere, and then there was a sort of an era of cold and blizzards. And then there was a terrible drought, and you can just find these bones.
That idea of the blinding flash, the terrible drought. Obviously, we can connect that to the belief that it was a comet that came and smashed into the earth, an asteroid that changed the future of the planet. Right.
Right. I mean, which is what modern scientists say about what killed all the dinosaurs. That's what they now say.
Right. But how old is that story you just told us?
That story was collected back in about 1880.
Okay.
But it's an ancient story. It's an oral tradition.
It's an okay, but collected in print 1880. Set in stone that at least it had existed as early as that.
Yeah.
Oral tradition goes back however long it goes before that. But that just goes to show you that's 100 years before it was really becoming popular science.
Oh, yeah. And, when the scientific story of the asteroid killing all the dinosaurs came out, everyone laughed.
Right. Okay. All right. Very good. Well, hang on. We'll come back. More of Adrian Mayer, the author of The First Fossil Hunters and Fossil Legends of the First Americans. And we'll get to the UFO in Greece and ancient Rome stories, too, next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. You know, look at Fossil Legends of the First Americans contain so many interesting monster stories. I like this one where one Pawnee elder recounted their earliest memories of what their people were and what they ate. It says the first men who lived on Earth were very large Indians, the Pawnee told an investigator on a recording. These giants were very big and very strong and used to hunt the buffalo on foot. They were so swift and strong that a man could run down a buffalo and kill it with a great stone or a club or even with his flint knife. A giant could throw a bull buffalo over his back as a hunter today carries an antelope, and he would tuck a yearling in his belt like a rabbit. And it goes into other stories. And at first you think, well, God, it's just, you know, obviously some sort of creation myth of self-importance or a imagined past that could never have actually been. And then you actually look at all the other things they get right. I mean, their drawings, the early Indian drawings on trees or in stone that show essentially sea monsters, which then later end up showing up in our actual archaeological record, but not until after they're dug up. I don't know. It's an incredible connection that Adrian Mayer is making in the Fossil Legends of the First Americans, and really worthy of exploring. I hope she gets more attention in mainstream circles on this, too. And I want to get back to that because there was a beast that I mentioned earlier, and I couldn't remember that it was the Terminator pig. There's a Native American term for them, like Bosh Kawash or something. We'll get back to that because they did roam, actually, here on these very same grounds where very early Americans would have been fighting with them, being eaten by them, trying to fight them off, maybe is a better way to say it. We'll get to that coming up, as well as the UFO stories of Greece and Rome, the ones that made it into the record in one form or another. How dare we dismiss these stories next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Adrian Mayer will take your questions coming up at the top of the hour. So let's pick up where we left off, talking about the UFO encounters and these hard to dismiss parallels between what now modern science accepts as being the comet that kills off the dinosaurs and legends of a bright light that comes from the sky that lands down that creates an ice age. It's like, oh, well, I heard that before. So that's very cool. Now, what about these UFO stories from Greece
amazingly,
and Rome?
Amazingly, we have three, the UFO classifications, close encounter of the first kind, second kind, and third kind, close encounter of the third kind. I have three close encounters of the first kind, UFOs from antiquity, and three in which there were actually occupants that appeared to be human. And these are documented in the ancient sources. So just quickly give you a little overview of them.
Take as much time as you want.
These are just amazing. They astound me. First of all, in what is now Turkey, 74 BC, so this is more than 2,000 years ago, a Roman army was marching across the plain toward the enemy army led by King Mithridates of Pontus. They were just, they're arrayed on the battlefield. They're about to engage in combat when out of the clear blue sky, a huge flaming thing landed right in the ground, slammed into the ground between the two armies. Everybody scattered. They came back to see it. There were thousands of witnesses, of course, and they described it as looking like molten silver, and it was shaped like a huge storage jar. In other words, it was shaped like a huge nose cone.
Yeah.
There's a NASA friend of mine, Richard Stothers, at Columbia University. He's a NASA scientist. He's trying to figure out what these things could be. He thought it could be a large bolide, like an extremely brilliant meteor. But a fresh meteor, when it lands on the ground, is almost always black. It wouldn't be silver, molten silver.
Well, but and back up if I'm wrong. I mean, how big of they describe it as being how big?
Well, he says that it had to be visible to the armies as it was coming through the air, you know, plunging, plummeting the ground. It had to be at least 5 feet, 6 feet across.
So if it's five or six feet across and it's big enough for to make this cut, wouldn't if that had been a meteor? I don't know my astrophysics or how this plays out in you know, geophysics for that matter, but it, if that hit the ground in between these two armies, would it have not wiped out both of those armies if that had been a comet?
And I think you're right. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that, we're talking
about
something.
You'd have shrapnel and everything, metal, dirt, everything. I mean, it was
I mean, we're not talking about something.
And this thing slammed into the ground. They say so.
So then you're talking about an explosion. Then you're talking about that would have created an enormous crater. But if it had been a ship,
and the guys wouldn't live to come back to look at it.
Right, they wouldn't have survived. So, but if it had been a ship, that would have been different. Then they would have cut into the earth, not in a way that would have been like a meteor.
Exactly.
Right.
So, and wait till you hear the next one. It's actually another large silver disk, and this was spotted in the Fayum Desert of Egypt, reported by the Bishop of Alexandria, Egypt, and it was the witness was Saint Anthony.
Well, there's been a few Saint Anthonys. I wonder which one.
He's the one who lived like a hermit in the desert. He was the hermit Saint Anthony. He, you know, he was very familiar with mirages. He wrote about mirages, so this was not a mirage. This was not when he was, like, fasting or anything. He just says that he observed something that looked like a very large silver disc some distance away from him on the surface of the desert, and he walked toward it, and it suddenly vanished like smoke. He describes mirages, and he doesn't say this one was a mirage. He thinks it was really there.
I think that's a story I've heard before, and I love the fact that you're bringing it up here.
Yeah.
And I forgot why. I think maybe even a previous guest on Coast to Coast is talking about that story too.
Yeah.
And I think what's really interesting about that is that you have a guy in the case of a hermit, like I think it's Saint Anthony the Great. I think is who that is, the guy in the desert, and that. What the hermits wanted more than anything was to keep people away.
Yes.
And they didn't want to attract them with stories or attract attention to themselves.
No.
They actually were, that's why they wanted to be hermits. So the fact that he saw something like this and reported it, I think that's very key, that it would be counterintuitive to what hermits wanted, which was more people gathering at their cave door.
Exactly. They're recluses.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Very good. All right. Very interesting. Fascinating. So that would have been third century. So we went like one century BC. Then it's that would probably be
That was AD 285. So
third century. Okay.
Yeah.
Right. All right.
Yeah,
so very cool.
Okay. And then there's another one. There was you've heard of these. There are modern reports of silver rain, sort of like strange light rain of substances, sort of gossamer like, whitish silver. Stuff. There were two reigns of that in 214 BC and 100 BC in Rome. Some people, it descended from a clear blue sky on the city of Rome, and there was a historian who collected some of the silver rain, Dio Cassius, very reliable historian, collected some of the rain on the ground and rubbed it onto some bronze coins, and the coin stayed silver for 3 days, and on the fourth day, it just disappeared. So that there are some modern reports of white or silver fibers falling from clear blue sky. Nobody knows what it is.
Exactly.
Sometimes it drops from a UFO disk and vanishes when it touches the ground. Other times it's like sort of like glass-like fibers.
Like almost like like fiberglass, almost like exactly what we have today.
Right, and it's found on the ground after a UFO takes off. So that. Those are the ones without any occupants. Now there's some with occupants.
I wonder if we're looking at, I mean, just to go with this here, just to, you know, why not? Is if we're looking at the heat exhaust of something that were taking off and it were over silica of some sort, that
it would fuse it into glass.
It would fuse it into glass.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. And was that the first encounter of the first kind?
Yeah, those are of the first kind because they're actually that's second because it leaves a physical trace. That's
right.
UFO close encounters of the second kind because they left a physical trace. And then now we're going to move on to the close
first
encounters
encounter.
Of the third kind, and that's okay. When there's observed UFO observed at close range in association with occupants that appear human or humanoid.
And what was this one?
This happened in Rome. It happened in 217 BC in many places in the countryside east of the city of Rome. So this is 2,200 years ago. The forms of men, completely dressed in clothes of shining white, were seen by many different groups of people in different villages. No UFO was mentioned. Then 3 years later, people in the same region spotted something overhead, clear blue sky once again, that looked like a large white marble altar in the sky. And around this unidentified flying object, they saw the forms of people dressed in shining white.
Hmm.
Fairly UFO-like.
Yeah, really?
Really,
and
yeah.
I'd love to see what a... I guess I never really
what an altar looks
considered,
like.
Yeah, what an altar looks like, a Roman altar looks like.
Well, I think it would be like what you imagine. It wouldn't have legs, though. It would be like a large rectangular.
Would it be shape. Rectangular? Or I don't know, because I know our altars are informed by sarcophagi.
Yeah, it could have a curved top.
Yeah, and I just don't know. I don't know what their altars, what a Roman, typical Roman altar would have looked like as opposed to
right,
a Christian altar.
If anyone wants to study these, that's exactly what they would have to look at. Yeah.
Very cool. Well, just like we've been doing all night, Adrian Mayer's work sort of straddles both sides of the Atlantic with both ancient Greece and Rome in the subject of the first fossil hunters and then fossil legends of first Americans back to our continent. And what was the name of that beast? I was trying to think of it before, the Oshkosh thing with the...
The Terminator pig?
Yeah, is that... And what was the native term for it? Did they have a...
I don't remember the native term for it.
I have to look for
it.
That's
what the paleontologists call it, though.
The Terminator pig. Now, talk about that.
Well, these are found in fossils that are found in around Agate Springs, Nebraska, so western Nebraska, South Dakota. And they are gigantic pig-like creatures, but they were probably carnivorous. So these really are really scary, scary beasts. And their fossils are some of the scariest-looking beasts I've ever seen. I mean, they really look like predators.
Yeah.
And they're gigantic. I've seen them. You can go to Agate Springs and see them set up in a they're all reconstructed, the skeletons. And I've got a picture of them in my book. They're constantly digging these right now. Actually, you can volunteer to dig. You can go to the pig dig.
Oh, cool.
Online, and you can volunteer to dig these Terminator pigs.
The Terminator dig. So they have. So if you, but these would have been then beasts that the early Americans might have been hunting.
I believe that these are probably these fossils at Agate Springs are Miocene. So that is before Paleo Indians arrived.
Okay, I don't know.
They certainly would have found the.
Was it in their legend that they were hunting them? Did they talk? Are there stories of them hunting these beasts?
There are stories of unidentifiable monsters that were really scary predators. I would assume that if they found these certainly fit the bill. It's a kind of Hogzilla thing. I mean, if you've ever
seen
these.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
They're bigger than Hogzilla, though.
It kind of reminds me, and I had to go look it up because it was driving me crazy. Boshquadosh.
Ah.
The huge monster called Boshquadosh. Can you talk about that?
And that's the one we couldn't figure out what it was. I had talked to so many people trying to figure out what they were trying to describe here.
This is an Iroquois legend?
Oh, I think so. Is it? We're not talking about the. Wait, we're not talking about the.
I'm gonna pull it. I'm gonna read it to you out of your own book. How about that?
Right.
Iroquois legends tell of frightening beasts such as big elk, the Abenaki great elk, for example, enormous serpents, a monster bear called the Nyagwahi, a giant animal of the cat kind, perhaps a saber-toothed cat, the horrible Kis-Kis, which furiously toppled houses, and a huge monster called the Bashkwadosh, speculating in 1825 that Kis-Kis may have referred to the mammoth. David Cusick was the first Indian writer to make an explicit connection between the real extinct mastodon fossils being discussed by scientists of his day and the traditional myths about giants and monsters.
That's right. He actually figured out that he long before any scientist, white scientist, he's the one who figured out that the oral legends from his tribe, Bashkwadosh, were actually referring to mastodons and mammoths. And of course they did hunt those. They did hunt those. So we,
right.
So this shows how old those legends can be. This means they can be, you know, more than 5,000, 6,000, maybe even 10,000 years old, these stories.
Right. And yeah. How interesting is that, that these Native Americans continue to pass down stories about, you know, hunting these giant elephants, and these giant elephants are eventually found in mass. I mean, where now we know they were all over the place. We just didn't
know.
You find
them in New York. You find them in New York State.
Right.
Everywhere. I think almost every state in the lower 48 has a mastodon, a prehistoric mastodon kill site. So they were everywhere, and they were hunted.
I'm going to read a little bit more.
Them, and they were dangerous to hunt.
I'm going to read more of you to you here on page 42. Iroquois myths of giants going extinct by fire and earthquake, trapped in marshy pits and under landslides, and huge bears, horned monsters, and monstrous heads buried in the ground raise the possibility that fossils may have contributed to the images. But these are not really fossil legends unless some version of the story directly connects the monstrous creatures with unusual remains, such as the skeletons, the bones, teeth, tusks, and stuff. And you've held the tooth of a monster. Was it a monster bear tooth that you were holding, or is it?
It was a mastodon tooth, which looks like the tooth of a carnivore because it's pointed and sharp.
Wow.
And that's why Jefferson and all the, you know, founding fathers, when they found this stuff, they found teeth like this. Mastodon teeth are pointed and sharp, so it looks like the molars of a predator. Surely this was a meat eater. And Jefferson called this the Ohio monster, because they found them along the Ohio River. And they had no idea what they were. They thought it was some kind of carnivorous monster. And Jefferson's wrote a lot of letters back to scientists in France saying, we've got some strange, big, dangerous animals here.
How about that? And then the same thing with the giant bear. And I saw something on the History Channel about this, so I know a little bit more about the giant bear than
giant,
I know about other.
Short-faced bear, really long legs, very fast.
Right.
Yeah.
And this would have been something that the early Americans would have hunted, or
absolutely,
would have been hunted by, too, at the same time?
They would run away from.
Right.
There are stories of a lot of oral traditions from the Iroquois tribes of fast champion runners having races with this bear, and then actually winning the race because it's a story, a myth,
right,
ends happily, and then the bear promises that it'll go extinct.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That's the penalty for the bear, if the kid can win the race against this. And these were really big bears. I mean, these were bigger than grizzly bears, and they had very long legs.
Well, good. Well, just this is where it'll end then. The fossil legends of the first Americans, or at least for my part, and then we'll bring everybody in here on the phone at coasttocoastam.com. We'll give you all of the numbers there, or hang on for a second, and we'll give you the numbers in just a moment on the air, and you can get into it. And perhaps you aren't Native American, so maybe we're talking about something that you know more about, too, that you've already experienced. Maybe you've heard these stories in your tribe that we haven't gotten to. Adrian Mayer's book is the follow-up to The First Fossil Hunters, and I'm going to make a prediction that at some point during this year, some story will come up, some something will be uncovered, some, you know, archaeological dig, or maybe something unintentional, like the breaking of the ground of a new building or digging of a foundation. And we'll have Adrian Mayer back on to talk about some new bones they've discovered somewhere that nobody thought they'd ever find. That's my prediction on that. The blog is up at coasttocoastam.com, and go see a picture of my dog, Jack. He's a beast in his own right. Your questions and comments next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Ponet.